Welcome to International Dispute Negotiation, your guide to resolving disputes everywhere.
This is Mike McElrath, and this podcast is about different ways of accepting and managing the risks of dispute resolution, presenting them through the eyes of experts from different countries and backgrounds.
The previous episode of IDN with Gary Bourne floated the idea of a company pledge to use arbitration as the default mechanism to resolve disputes in international contracts. As an existing model to follow, the CPR Institute's pledge for mediation has over 5,000 signatories today. After that episode, Gary and I received a number of comments from people expressing interest, and we learned that CPR is considering the idea as a possible initiative to pursue. This week's episode continues my discussion with Gary and addresses some of the questions raised, including what form an arbitration pledge would need to take in order to make it attractive to parties engaged in international commerce, as well as being legally enforceable. Gary's the head of the international arbitration practice of the WilmerHale firm in London and author of the highly regarded treatise International Commercial Arbitration and other popular texts on the subject.
If this were just a pledge along the lines of the CPR pledge, which could be enforced, if you will, through a letter from one general counsel to the other of the sort that Michael, you outlined previously and identified as having, while being non-binding, nonetheless having real practical consequences in terms of getting parties to actually do things they might not otherwise do.
No, actually, the CPR pledge that says we agree to submit disputes to arbitration. I mean, it's, mediation is ultimately non-binding, so there's always an out. Mm. But it does have something of a tough language.
Yeah.
It's not we'll just consider it. There's a commitment to attempt to resolve the dispute through mediation.
And so in its weak form, the fact that it wasn't legally binding or enforceable ought not to be an objection.
Well, yeah, but other than its weak form, I don't think it's going to be that utilized.
And it's possible.
And the reason I'm skeptical about it, it's the uptake of the weaker format, or the weaker proposal, if it's being an option or whether they'll consider arbitration or unless they don't want to, they'll use arbitration, is that it becomes then a point of, you and I face this probably many times, and that is it's just a tactical decision. Are we advantaged by arbitration in this particular instance, or are we not advantaged? Mm-hmm. And I would bet that in a lot of cases, you know, at least one of the parties is going to say, I'm better off not being with an expeditious or efficient form of dispute resolution. Or they may say, I do want expeditious, and I want it to be the courts, which I'm in Germany, and the courts are efficient here. I don't want arbitration.
There are two stages in the process that one could look at the general counsel letter. One would be a dispute has arisen, and I think all of our experience is once a dispute has actually crystallized, parties begin to focus on particular tactical benefits in that. Are they slightly better off than the other side, or less bad off? Even if the whole process is going to cost more money and be more unpredictable and more uncertain, if one party thinks it's slightly less bad off than the other party, it will choose the worst option once a dispute has
arisen. And you and I have probably both led those charges.
Speak for yourself, Michael. there is another step in this particular model, though, of the process, which is the contracting stage. And I put out there as a hypothesis, you might have different views, at the contracting stage when one is saying, let's put in an arbitration clause, it may be that a company-wide commitment to look to arbitration as the means, default means of dispute resolution, where both parties to a particular contract have already company-wide made that commitment, it might be that the existence of that pledge would make it more likely that arbitration would be agreed in the particular contract, where I think there is more flexibility between the parties. In the strong form, one would need to look carefully at the questions of enforceability. Right. There's, as I've mentioned, the question of defined legal relationship. There's a broader, under the New York Convention model law, there is a more overarching question, which would be what law governs this instrument? One would need to conclude what law the instrument should be subjected to.
What you mean, the instrument being the agreement to submit disputes to arbitration, or the separate agreement document that's being, that's the subject of the arbitration, the contract?
The first.
Because the second issue, I would always keep that separately in the contract. Yeah. You have your governing law that you agree, and it doesn't have to be part of the dispute resolution clause. It could be a separate.
That's precisely right. I think the question of what law governs a particular contractual relationship that the two parties might enter into the future ought to be left to that particular contract. Look, what I was raising is, and this takes the separability doctrine to gives it a new meaning in a sense, what law would govern the separate arbitration instrument that committed two parties to arbitrate whatever future international commercial disputes arose between them.
Independently of a contract.
Exactly. So there is a standalone arbitration agreement then. And there would be a question as to what law ought to govern that. Our French friends would tell us the answer is easy, international law.
Lex mercatoria.
Friends in other jurisdictions probably would have other answers. But in principle, as with any contractual relationship, this is a matter that could be worked out through drafting and choice of law clauses.
Well, I would think that this is one where you would launch and learn to an extent, in that you would have to do the best job that you can in trying to predict these potential objections to it. But if this is a success, if this were to be a successful initiative, you would also assume there'd be to be some jurisprudence that would evolve in different state courts. And, you know, given that information flows even between countries these days, a decision in France might very well gain some ground in England or in the U.S. or in other jurisdictions.
I think that's exactly
and then,
right.
And then you'd have to go back to the instrument then and adapt it 5 or 6 years down the road and tweak it in light of any cases that came out as addressing this.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I think critics would also raise, beyond questions of enforceability, they would also raise questions as to both the desirability and the need for such mechanism. With regard to desirability, I could imagine skeptics saying, why should we agree to arbitrate with anybody who might come along and want to arbitrate with us in the future? Wouldn't that open us up to the possibility of claims from unknown third parties, people who we might have no desire to walk down the same street with, much less enter into a contractual relationship with? And I think that, you know, that is the sort of concern that needs to be considered, taken seriously. It could be addressed in part through definition of who it is may be signatory to the instrument by limiting it. And I think it should be limited, frankly, to major commercial entities. I'm not sure one needs to talk about the sort of Fortune 1000, but to large commercial entities or large commercial entities in a particular sector, one would address most and probably all of that concern. And I don't think that this mechanism, I want to make quite clear, this mechanism isn't envisaged for things like consumer disputes or disputes with individuals or employees or matters like that. This is a mechanism for resolving international commercial disputes, and it ought to be confined to the sort of set category of entities that engage in that sort of commerce. One could attempt as well to assuage concerns about there may be people we don't want to arbitrate with by opt-out mechanisms. If a company wanted in undertaking to join the arbitration mechanism to say, but not with regard to A or B, the company could do that.
Or you may have provisions with respect to certain types of claims, whether competitors or fraud claims, where you have safeguards that you could carve out within the. I would also think that one of the concerns could be addressed just by making sure that the general rule about cost following the event would tend to discourage frivolous claims. And I can see some in-house counsel raising objections. Well, am I opening myself up to just anybody coming along and starting an arbitration and driving up costs and trying to get out of us a nuisance settlement? You would think that the general rule of the loser has to pay the cost following the event ought to be a pretty good factor to discourage that sort of reckless behavior.
I think that's a very good point. In a sense, any company's already open to frivolous claims in national courts of whatever jurisdiction a potentially frivolous claimant wants to bring a claim. And the fact that costs do follow the event in most cases in international arbitration ought to be an existing and serious impediment to that sort of behavior. The second question would be, is this necessary? Can't we already negotiate an international arbitration agreement?
Don't we already do it?
And to some extent, the answer to that is yes. There are obviously lots of international commercial arbitration clauses out there. Indeed, I think unstated premise of the proposal is that we know international commercial arbitration is very popular because companies use it so much. Right. And in a sense, it's almost like a tipping point, if you will. It is precisely because companies so often use international commercial arbitration that one can say it therefore ought to be the presumptive default mechanism.
Or what you're saying is standardization. This is a way of standardizing practice. We'd have a common practice and it would tend to be a slightly more predictable. If we all adhere to this,
That's another way to look at it. That is another way to look at it. But I think that beyond standardization, there are instances where contractual relationships fall through the contracting process net, if you will. Companies sometimes don't put in liability limitation provisions. Companies sometimes don't even execute the contractual documentation. There are numerous instances in which, although companies as institutions would like international commercial arbitration, they don't actually agree to that, or at least agree in a binding way in a particular case to that. And this would... The concept of the strong form of the mechanism would simply flip the default rule and make it into the way the dispute would be resolved unless parties did something differently.
Right. And I think one thing you would need to also consider in this, or at least as a potential objection, is that the risk or potential for multi-party proceedings to be initiated. And I would think that there has to be some type of a mechanism, either to, if you don't allow it, to say how it's going to happen. I mean, the usual example, if you have three arbitrators, I appoint one, you appoint one, and then we have a way of appointing the third. If we've got three or four or five parties, that becomes rather a difficult process.
It's a very interesting point, Mike. One of the criticisms of international commercial arbitration these days, I think, is that it doesn't deal as well as it should with multi-party disputes.
Interesting you say that, because I think one of the advantages of international commercial arbitration today is that it limits disputes to the parties to the contract.
That's interesting. That can be the topic of a separate podcast. because one certainly hears in some quarters the criticism that you can't consolidate related disputes either between the same parties or between related parties, if you will, either affiliates or subcontractors and the like, and thereby run the risk of inconsistent judgments, decisions, and experience inefficiency.
Yeah, well, they're all wrong,
That's another podcast.
You address this in your book, right? We have a separate conversation. That would have been a good topic of conversation.
Next time.
Process of joint or multi-party. It's interesting that you didn't mention, though, what I think would be the biggest impediment to this concept of, let's say, an arbitration pledge, an international arbitration pledge, and that is the skepticism, or let's say the... resistance to arbitration that is being expressed in many quarters. I think it's often misunderstood. I think there are groups like the Corporate Counsel International Arbitration Group, whose very existence is taken sometimes to be a sign of hostility towards arbitration when it's not at all. I mean, I don't read the CCIAG to be hostile towards arbitration, but to rather to be users of arbitration expressing what they would like to see in the practice. Say, you want to provide services to us? Well, we're the ones who are paying for the services. We're going to give you our view so you can better provide them. But I do think there are, in some quarters, relatively hostile views about whether arbitration should be used. I mean, I'm aware of some companies which have, rather than having a pledge about using arbitration, have virtually banned arbitration in their organizations. So that's certainly one thing you would expect to have to encounter.
Yeah. No, clearly there will be companies who, or at least companies at some stages in their existence, who wouldn't want to sign the pledge.
And I have to tell you, we have lots of different views as to what arbitration should be and how it should be practiced. I don't know how those companies do business. Maybe they don't internationally.
I think that's a very good point. My sense is that these are often companies that either have a predominantly domestic focus to their business or are in a period of transforming from a principally domestic company into a collection of principally domestic companies, and haven't yet quite understood the sorts of things that UGE realized decades ago about international dispute resolution. There are also, I think, and one has to recognize this, I think there is room for fair debate about the strengths and weaknesses of international arbitration, both in general and also in specific instances. And the question is it sufficiently useful in general? Is it sufficiently less bad in general than the alternatives that one would want to make it the default rule? I think there's, there is fair room for debate about whether international arbitration has turned into a form of offshore litigation, as one Continental in-house counsel put it a few years ago, or conversely, whether international arbitration has simply had to adapt to the extraordinary complexity of some of the complexity, technically, commercially, legally, and otherwise, of some disputes that arise today, and nonetheless continues to provide the least bad alternative.
And one final consideration you may want to include, or we may want to include in this charter or instrument or treaty.
I like the "we" there, Michael.
Well, how many lawyers are you in London? I'm just thinking of the resources that will be necessary to get down to actually drafting. About the legal issues here. It's simple to go with the idea of the concept. The execution is where the real
devil's
work
in the details. As you said before.
If one consideration is you have a notion of small claims. We have, for example, an ODR process that we use here for disputes under 50,000 euros, where they go automatically, they should, into supplier disputes, into an online mediation / arbitration on the basis of documents only. So we've done a sort of a carve out of disputes below a certain size. I wonder if for a document like this, or an agreement like this, a multilateral agreement of this nature, you would want to make it applicable only for disputes over a certain size,
I think one could certainly consider that sort of.
And users like us may have more comfort saying, all right, well, for really, the $500,000 claims or the $50,000 claims, we really don't want to be, worrying about whether we need one or three arbitrators. But, for claims between 5 million and 15 million, one arbitrator. For claims over 15 million, three arbitrators, even though, as Jennifer Kirby has rightly pointed out, in fact, on this podcast, the amount in dispute is not something that necessarily, it's the complexity, not the amount in dispute, that should ought to be the determining factor, whether it's one or three.
From my perspective, this is the sort of internal discussion that companies would want to have in deciding whether or not to take the pledge. And, some companies might well decide, were this this concept ever to be more than just a podcast, whether they wanted to do that.
You've been listening to International Dispute Negotiation. This podcast is presented by the International Institute for Conflict Prevention and Resolution, CPR. CPR is a membership-based nonprofit organization that promotes excellence and innovation in public and private dispute resolution, providing an international resource for the avoidance, management, and resolution of business disputes. For further information about CPR, or to download archived versions of this podcast, go to www.cpradr.org. Questions about this podcast or the issues discussed can be addressed to idn@cpradr.org. The music of Note Noir is used with permission.